I may have been gone for an inordinate amount of time, but I'm not dead yet. You're listening to Eddie V's Horror Show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Eddie V's Horror Show. I am Edward Villanova, author, YouTuber, and the host of this damn fine podcast. Yes, I've been MIA for months, I know. I've had a lot going on, which, I mean, honestly, I could tell you about, but, I mean, it's really not that interesting. Just tedious and related to me having to put, you know, paying the bills over content creation, but c'est la vie. It doesn't matter, I'm back, and I'm back at it. So welcome to 2024. It is February by now, so I already missed a little January, but that's all right. We're getting back in the saddle. And so that makes this technically season 5 of the show. I'm thinking of doing away with the seasons and just making the show be what it is. I don't know. I'm still thinking it over. I might keep the seasons. I might ditch them. But either way, I've got some good stuff planned for this year. I have a few themes planned out, a few guests lined up, new ones, and hopefully some returning guests, and of course, a lot more booze and sloshy horror talk. You know you like it. You know, I say I'm a YouTuber at the top of every damn episode, and I've really only had one video out for a long time, not including a joke video featuring a heavily edited scene from The Lighthouse that I probably needed to go ahead and delete for being as dumb as it is disgusting a long time ago. But anyway, that's gone now. In a bid to legitimize my opening claim, I put out a new video that took way too long to make, but it's done and it's up. And I'll probably shoot for some simpler topics in the future. And I'll be rolling out a few new videos this year and beyond, as I had originally intended when I first started my YouTube channel. I don't know how often I'll realistically be able to upload right now, but, I mean, it would certainly help with the old cash flow issue if I managed to somehow attract a partnership deal with YouTube and become a real bona fide YouTube content creator. If I may be gauche for a moment. I'm not exactly making bank over here with all my content creation yet. I'm rolling on my fourth year of hosting this podcast. Fourth or fifth year now? Fourth year? Man, I lose track so easily. Fifth year, I think. And I managed to rake in a generous $215 from a combination of ad revenue and a couple of one-time contributors. So if you like what you're hearing and you have a few bucks to throw my way to help me keep the lights on, please consider swinging by my Patreon page and becoming a patron today. Patreon.com/EdwardVillanova. If you'd like to support the show or my writing in another way, check out my merch store, Eddie V's Shop of Horrors. I've got lots of stuff, not just related to me or the show, but to horror appreciation in general, and it's all designed by yours truly. I never use AI creation tools or steal images off the internet or any of the other shady things they tell you to do in those TikTok videos. I do it all myself, and I like to think it's pretty good quality stuff, so swing on by if you want to peruse my wares. I'll put a link in the description, but it's also on my website, edwardvillanova.com. And just click on the shop link. Okay, panhandling over. Let's dive on in here. This is episode number 56, and I've got another potentially controversial episode coming for you. We're going to be talking about a more divisive topic in horror, and that is the topic of revulsion. Now, revulsion is a term that describes gross-out horror, things like body horror, zombie pull-apart scenes, exploding humans, cannibalism, and other unconventional things consumed. Does revulsion make the horror experience scarier? Let's explore that. But first, it wouldn't be a proper episode unless I tell you what I'm drinking. And the ultimate showdown is finally upon us, ladies and gentlemen, the Battle of the Rums. I have with me a bottle of Diplomatico Reserva Exclusiva, and I have a bottle of Boom Boo Original. Now, if you've been following this show, I've been trying to nail down what my all-time favorite rum is. And a little bit of backstory. I'm really more of a Scotch guy. I've been a Scotch guy for some time. But I've had my favorites of each type of liquor pretty well established for years now. And for about the last 15 years, my favorite type of rum was a dark rum called Kraken. And I like darker rums anyway. But yeah, Kraken was my favorite. That lovely pitch black squid ink Dr. Pepper tasting rum. My favorite light rum was Seven Fathoms Grand Cayman rum. But I was a guest on another podcast. Shout out to the WTF Bro podcast with Dean and Tim. I mentioned them so much, I feel like I should call them our sister podcast by now. But I guess I'd have to talk to them about that. But I was a guest on their show, and they were drinking Diplomatico. And being the lush that I am, I drank so much of it that I got completely plastered on the air and was rambling incoherently by the end of the episode. It was smooth, but I was not. But it was. It was very smooth, very delicious, and I couldn't stop drinking it. It was so mild, it may have well as been a cocktail rather than straight liquor. And I drank it like it was a cocktail instead of straight liquor. And before I knew it, I was loopy. Given that experience, Diplomatico instantly became my new favorite dark rum, which, like I said, is my preference over the lighter rums. And it reigned supreme on my personal rum throne for about 6 months. Then, again, I was with Dean and Tim, and we weren't recording, but we were just kind of hanging out, chilling, shooting the shit. And they busted out this bottle of Boom Boom that they swore was even better than Diplomatico. I was pretty intrigued because Diplomatico had already impressed me so much. So I tried some, and holy shit, it was the smoothest rum I'd ever had. And it was a lighter rum too, which I don't typically like as much. And it was really sweet, and I don't typically like overly sweet rums either. But it was so good, like the sweetness, it was sweet without being sicky sweet. And it blew my mind. I'd never had a straight rum that tasted so good. In the moment, though. And I thought, okay, maybe this really is my new favorite, but I want to try them back to back to be sure. So I tried to get both bottles, and I guess word got around that this stuff is amazing, because for the last couple of months, I have not been able to find a Boom Boom anywhere. Every liquor store I've tried has been sold out of it, the Boom Boom Original at least. But finally, I found some Boom Boom Original in stock, and I snatched it up, and I have a bottle of Diplomatico here, and a bottle of Boom Boom, and finally, I will be trying these back-to-back on the air and making a final ruling on which of these rums reigns supreme. At least as far as my personal palate is concerned. Alright, so first we're going to start with the Diplomatico. And I have not tried these back-to-back yet. I have tried them separately many times, especially the Diplomatico, because it's not that hard to find. Diplomatico first. Very good. Very flavorful. I don't want to go too much into the flavor palette. I've done that already. And now the Boom Boom Original in this second glass. Very different. It's a very different experience from the Diplomatico. It's a lot sweeter. And yeah, it's a lot smoother. Like, and I was wowing over how smooth the Diplomatico was. And the Boom Boom is just, it's so smooth. I've never had a straight alcohol this smooth before. It's insane. I gotta try the other one. Yeah. So, like I said, Boom Boom is just insanely smooth. It has a very, very good flavor. But overall, the flavor palette, if you will, it's richer in the Diplomatico. I get notes of like everything from wood and leather and tobacco smoke to like maple syrup and hazelnut coffee. And it's a very broad spectrum of flavors for the Diplomático. The Bumbu, for as smooth as it is, the flavor profile is pretty flat. The notes that I'm getting are like banana, brown sugar, taffy. I get a little tobacco smoke flavor in there as well. Overall, both of these are absolutely amazing rums. And if you're a rum drinker, you've probably already tried both of these. It's a tough call. I gotta say, personally for me, I do like the Diplomático a little bit better for how diverse that flavor profile is. But if I'm in the mood for simple, straight up sipping rum, man, I can definitely see choosing Bumbu on occasion over Diplomático. But wow, I mean, both absolutely spectacular rums. Yeah, final ruling. Diplomático edges out the Bumbu by a hair. By a hair. All right. Back to the show, for all of you that are not interested in the liquor talk at all. We talk about Orson Scott Card's Three Types of Fear a lot on this show. And just as a recap, or if you're new, according to Orson Scott Card, there are three types of fear. They are dread, terror, and horror. Dread is the most potent kind of fear. It's when you know something is wrong, you sense that a threat exists, but that threat remains unknown. It's mysterious, and it builds tension. And whatever possibilities you can come up with within your mind are almost surely scarier than whatever it actually is. Terror is the least potent form of fear. It's a clear and imminent direct threat when the threat has revealed itself and is actively attempting to harm or kill. This is when Leatherface is chasing the final girl with his chainsaw. That's the terror. It sounds like it should be the scariest, but it's really not. Not as an observer, at least. The third type is horror, and it has less to do with the threat itself, and is more about the totality of the situation. This is the moment the character grasps how truly horrible or terrifying their situation really is. The example I like to give is that the axe murderer has already attacked you. The axe has severed your spine, you're paralyzed, unable to speak, laying in the middle of the floor, but you're alive and conscious. The killer uses you as bait, and all you can do is watch as he ambushes your family members one by one as they walk into the room, see you but not the killer, and try to help you. That's horror. There are other horror authors who have similar lists like this, not just Orson Scott Card, but I use his because they're the most succinct and they make the most sense to me. Now, one of the other authors that has a type of horror, or a horror hierarchy, if you will, is Stephen King. You may have heard of him. And according to King, these three types are terror, horror, and revulsion. Now, the first two are also on Orson Scott Card's Three Types of Fear, and their definitions are swapped, but they're basically the same. According to King, terror is the most potent form of fear, representing the tense moments of unease when you know something's wrong, but you don't know what it is yet. Horror, according to King, is when the threat emerges and attacks, but the odd one out in King's Three Types of Fear is the one that isn't on Card's scale of fear at all, revulsion. And King says that revulsion is the least potent form of fear, representing gross-out horror. People melting, spiders crawling out of someone's mouth, improbable levels of blood splatter, and airborne entrails. This is where Stephen King and Orson Scott Card split in their interpretation of what is scary, and that difference in opinion is what our episode is about today. What role does revulsion play in horror? Now, because this is going to cover kind of a wide array of yuckiness, I'm adopting Stephen King's word revulsion to cover all of it. At first, I was going to ask, is revulsion horror? But I already know the answer to that. Stephen King and Orson Scott Card have already sort of exemplified for us with their differences and types of fear. It's subjective. Some will find revulsion scary and others won't. And the horror genre is so broad and diverse, revulsion will fit well into some things and not at all into others. In a slasher, I would say it's not complete without at least a little bit of revulsion. Blood splatter, entrails, maybe torture scenes depending on the franchise. Sci-fi horror is rich in body horror, which fits well for the most part, but you can certainly have a sci-fi horror film without any revulsion at all. But in a mind-bender, a psychological horror, revulsion may be somewhat out of place. Now, when I think of revulsion, one of the first things that comes to mind is body horror. And if we're going to talk about body horror, we have to talk about the director that I lovingly refer to as Captain Monster Porn, David Cronenberg. Now, I've said it before, I'm not a fan of body horror in and of itself. It's usually kind of goofy, even when it's well done. The basis of the majority of David Cronenberg's films is body horror. This is so well known that disgusting monsters that used to be human in horror movies are often referred to as Cronenbergs by horror heads, even if it's not a David Cronenberg film. The TV show Rick and Morty famously refers to the universe where they accidentally turned everyone into shambling mutated monsters, the Cronenberg universe. And let me tell you, I am not a fan of the gross-out monstrosities we get to see in his films, even though many of them, I have to admit, are pretty damned inventive, and almost always practical effects too, which kudos to that in this age of CGI being in absolutely everything. But despite my dislike of body horror, there's no denying that David Cronenberg is an amazing director. He has several non-body horror films to his name, too. Eastern Promises, for example, is a brilliant Cronenberg film, and there's not a lick of body horror in it. I mean, you know, unless you count seeing Viggo Mortensen's baloney pony flopping around as he fights a group of assassins completely naked in a public shower fight scene that goes on way longer than anybody wanted it to. But outside of getting dick-whipped and teabagged by Aragorn, nobody melted or turned into a disgusting hamburger monster. So, I know it's rich, me saying that I don't like gross-out horror, when, to date, my most recent published work is Splatterpunk, and it looks like my next one will be Splatterpunk as well. But largely, I don't like gross-out horror. I can deal with it for a really good story, and Cronenberg delivers these in spades. Existence is one example of this. It's an amazing and underappreciated sci-fi that, in many ways, is a sort of precursor to the movie Inception, with groups of people linking up their minds to play a game that works like a shared dream. Except it's way grosser than Inception. They have these weird biological guns that look like dermoids or something. If you don't know what a dermoid is, Google it. It's gross. It's like a part of a spinal column and maybe the rib cage of a chicken, these guns. It's covered in meat and it fires human teeth. And if the gun gets damaged, it bleeds. If you've played the video game Scorn or seen any footage, there's a gun in it that looks a lot like the guns from Existence. So much so that I would be surprised if they didn't model it after these guns intentionally. It even appears to fire human teeth, or something small, white, and not exactly round. But aside from having grotesque guns, to play the game in Existence, you have to have a hole permanently drilled into your spine. And these spine holes, first of all, they straight up look like buttholes. Like, there's no two ways about it. But in the film, these spinal port things are weirdly and grotesquely sexualized. There's even a close-up of someone getting their spinal port tongued as a form of foreplay. And it's super fucking disgusting because, first of all, it's basically a fucking open wound that gives direct access to the spinal cord. That sexy, sexy spinal cord. And second of all, it looks like a butthole. And no offense to anybody who's into that, no shade, no judgment from me. But when I'm minding my own business watching a sci-fi film, I don't expect to get ambushed with surprise rim job footage. And this is not the only time we see body horror sexualized in the David Cronenberg film. In fact, I'm pretty sure it feeds into some weird kink he has. Like, they say everyone seems normal until you see their internet search history, but I feel like if you saw David Cronenberg, you'd come away with PTSD. But grossness aside, Existence is an excellent film, and even if you don't like gross-out horror, I still recommend it. Like, I don't like it. I don't like gross-out horror, and I still like that movie. But the burning question is, did the gross-out horror add anything to the film? And honestly, in this case, I mean, I would say no. Other than it made it feel like a signature David Cronenberg film. But this would have worked just as well with regular, non-biological guns, and without drilling people new buttholes. Like, The Matrix did it, and it worked out just fine. Do we have to have butthole ports? I don't think so. But body horror, especially David Cronenberg body horror, can't really be discussed without talking about his most infamously disgusting film, and rated by many people as the most disgusting film ever made, 1986's The Fly. And I need another drink before I talk about this movie. Oh, Diplomatico, take me away. The Fly is easily the grossest movie I've ever seen in my entire life. Despite my dislike of body horror, I'm really not that easily grossed out, but this movie made me feel sick, and it's really a great film. One that I would actually love to watch again if it weren't for how incredibly vomit-inspiring it truly is. I've actually watched it 3 times, several years apart each time, and each time I hope that I misremembered how gross it is, because I remember the story, and I liked the story, and each time I'm left going, man, that was a really great movie, but I'm going to go throw up now. You know, from the fingernail pulling scene, to the puking on a donut before eating it scene, to the giving birth to a giant maggot dream sequence, or when his head falls apart, or when his skin sloughs off, or when he's walking around looking like a hot dog that got microwaved for too long, or when he barfs acid into the other guy's face, or when he gets genetically meshed with not only the fly, but the teleportation pod itself, or any of the other countless barf-your-guts-out scenes that this film is packed to the rafters with. David Cronenberg made it clear that he wasn't holding back when he made this film. It feels like he really went out of his way to dream up the most vile things imaginable, and putting them on screen as vividly and stomach-churningly as possible. And as gross as this movie is, there are deleted scenes the studio just couldn't keep in the final release. I'm kind of a hound for deleted scenes, especially when it comes to, you know, when it was things the studio cut because it was just too extreme. You know, I like going and finding that stuff, but let me tell you, I haven't seen the extra scenes from The Fly that they cut out for being too gross. I just have no desire whatsoever to see it, because what they left in, there's so much in there that already is just the nastiest fucking shit I've ever seen. It borders on extreme horror, like I Spit on Your Grave or Cannibal Holocaust and How Hard It Is to Watch. But it's pretty much never categorized as such. It's been broadcast on network TV, for crying out loud, whereas true extreme horror, like those two other films, absolutely never would be. But, I don't know, maybe I'm just especially sensitive to how gross it is. I don't know. It seems like if it was as gross as I remember it, it wouldn't have been on network TV. But that's the thing. Like, that's what I keep doing to myself. I go, man, this was on TV. How could it really be as gross as I remember it? And then I watch it and I go, fuck it, man. It is. It's just as gross as I remember it. Anyway. But for all the nauseating scenes in this film, unlike with Existence, I do think the gross-out element, the body horror, the revulsion, it adds to the film. it adds to the horror of the film, almost in the same way cosmic dread adds to Lovecraftian horror. There is very much a sense of the characters being helplessly out of control of the grotesque existential horror that is unraveling, all because one man found a way to wield a power he didn't understand and was ultimately unable to wield it without bringing about his own demise in the most gross-ass way imaginable. It reminds me of another Jeff Goldblum film. You were so busy thinking about the fact that you could, you never stopped to think whether or not you should. Great line. Very quotable film, Jurassic Park. Anyway, now that being said, I do think that this film could have been equally effective without being so over-the-top repulsive. I don't know this for certain, but I believe this is a reimagining of Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, which is a story about a man who's turning into a giant cockroach. And that story is pretty gross too, but it's not nearly as disgusting as The Fly, the 1986 Fly. There's a one from, what, 1957 or so? 57, 58, something like that. But yeah, it's not, obviously back then, it's not as gross as the 86 Cronenberg The Fly. I feel like the level of revulsion in Metamorphosis would have done just fine. Cronenberg didn't have to amp it up so much. He didn't have to crank the dial all the way to 11. But, you know, I mean, that's... Cronenberg is not a good enough kind of guy. Like, he swung for the sick-ass fences, and boy, did he knock it out of the park and into the toxic waste dump. He really did. So, there are also other films that their entire purpose is gross-out horror. And that is chiefly the only type of horror that there really is in the film. The movie that comes to mind right away, as far as body horror only, is Human Centipede. Now, just for your information, Violet Church, who is often a guest on this podcast, she and I are good friends, and I'm banned from mentioning that film around her. If somehow you're not aware of what Human Centipede is, it is about a mad scientist who attempts to create a quote-unquote human centipede by sewing three people together. This is against their will. They have all been kidnapped. And they are sewn together ass to mouth, ass to mouth. So they're all sharing a digestive tract. And that's the basis of the film. I mean, there is a story, and it's not a good one. Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, it delivers on what it advertises. If you want to see the plight of three people that are sewn together ass to mouth, this is your film, I guess? I mean, I was not intrigued by this film. I sort of watched this film against my will because I knew what it was about, and I didn't want to watch it, but I was with people who really wanted to watch it, and so I said, okay, I guess maybe it'll be better than I think, and it was just not. It was gross. It was disgusting, and I didn't enjoy the film at all. So the fact that they made more of these movies, they made a 2, and I believe a 3, maybe they made a 4, I don't know if they're still making them or not, but they made at least a 2, and I'm pretty sure they made a 3, tells me that there are people out there that enjoy all that wild ass-to-mouth action. Do I feel like the revulsion in this film added to it at all? Well, I mean, it has to. It has to, because it's the only thing that this movie's bringing to the table. So, I didn't find this movie scary at all. I just found it fucking disgusting. So, can you really say it added something to it? I mean, not to me. Not in my opinion. I guess the real question here, the overarching question is, does revulsion belong in the three types of fear? Well, there's a reason why I use Orson Scott Card's rubric instead of Stephen King's. I don't think revulsion should be its own type of fear. more that it can be a subclass of any of the three types. In The Fly, revulsion is part of the overall horror. Like I said, it's something akin to existential horror or cosmic horror. In a movie like The Thing, which, again, despite being a body horror film, is in my top five favorite horror movies of all time, revulsion is used mostly as a subclass of terror, a clear and present danger that is made even scarier by how gross the thing that's trying to kill you is. But it's also used to amp up the paranoia. You never know who is human and who is actually the thing. At any moment, anyone could turn into an inside-out hamburger monster who wants to eat you with its chest mouth and its ribs for teeth. And that fits solidly into the category of dread. So revulsion can be a part of dread, terror, or horror, depending on how it's used. It can be an amplifier of any of the three types of fear, but I don't think it should be categorized as a type of fear in and of itself. Something gross is not inherently scary, but a gross-out factor can make an already scary situation even scarier. Maybe that is why there is such a division over revulsion. To some people, something that is gross is scary. I'm just not one of those people. Grossness doesn't scare me at all. It's unpleasant. It can elicit a similar response to fear. It can make me want to run away. It can make me want to, you know, get out of there. It can make me feel queasy, just like fear. So it's possible that that is the correlation being drawn, or it could be that some people really are afraid of things that are disgusting. But it's just not so to me. Like, one of the grossest things I've ever encountered was in my parents' garage, of all places. They had these freezers that they kept out in the garage for long-term food storage, but they didn't go out to the garage super often. Well, for whatever reason, both of these freezers quit working, and they didn't go out to the garage for months. So it was summer in Texas, triple degree heat, it was like 105 in the shade, and there was no air conditioning in the garage, and they started smelling something nasty in the house. And they actually thought like an animal had gotten into the walls and died or something. So, being the good son that I am, I volunteered to come over, locate it, and dispose of it for them. And when I got there, I had vastly underestimated the stink. Like, it was so bad in the house, I could barely stand it. I actually went out to the garage to find some gloves before I started trying to cut into the walls and locate it. And when I went out there, I got knocked on my ass by a stench of biblical proportions. I knew that's where the smell was coming from. It was something in the garage, and I didn't have to guess for long. See, the gases that built up from the rotting Thanksgiving turkeys that were in the freezers when they went bad created enough pressure to push the door of one of the freezers open. These were not cooked turkeys. They were raw, previously frozen turkeys left over from Thanksgiving, still in their plastic wrapping. Four of them. Two per freezer. Why they had four uncooked Thanksgiving turkeys, I don't recall, but they ended up with extra turkeys somehow. And the freezer that was open was bad enough. It was the worst fucking thing I'd ever smelled in my life. But it still wasn't as disturbingly repulsive as the freezer that stayed shut. When I opened the door, it seemed that one of the rotting turkeys had inflated its sealed wrapping like a balloon, and it was still there, intact, swollen up, taking up most of the top shelf. But the other one, the one that was on the shelf below it, had burst, and apparently when it exploded, it slung rotten goo all over the insides of the freezer. And when I pulled the door open, there were these grayish-white, ropey vines, for lack of a better term, that were attached to the inside of the door that stretched and snapped as I pulled the door open. Between that and the stank, I had to run outside and puke. Like, to this day, I don't know why the hell I didn't just duct tape the doors shut, load them up in a truck, and haul them to the dump. No, instead, for some reason, I cleaned those damn freezers. I don't know why. It's not like I was going to save the freezers. Like, even if they had worked at that point, they would have been, just throw those things away. But for some reason, I cleaned them. I still don't know why. I was trying to be a good son. It took several hours and several trash bags and several applications of Vicks to the inside of my nostrils to block the stink that made its way through the bandana I was wearing over my face before I got all that fucking sick-ass turkey shit out of there. And then, of course, since they were broken anyway, my dad had someone come pick up the cleaned-out freezers and haul them to the dump. So, you're welcome, junk guy, for not having to haul the nasty-ass freezers. I cleaned them out for you. You're welcome. I guess I just hated myself and wanted to play in rotting turkey juices, I guess. I was embracing my inner Cronenberg. That's probably what it was. But even though that was incredibly revolting, at no time was I scared by the situation. Now, if that fucking sick-ass bird sprouted tentacles and started coming after me, I would have been scared shitless. Much more so than if there had been, like, a wild animal inside that attacked me when I opened the door. Or, you know, even, let's say, an alien or some kind of other creature I didn't understand. If there was somehow a ghost in the freezer or whatever, yes, it would have scared the shit out of me. But it wouldn't have scared me as much as that fucking rotting bird if it had animated somehow and come after me. That would have been far more scary. So, all in all, it does add something. Yes, it depends on the context. But something gross, it does add somewhat to the fear. It can amplify the fear. Does that mean there's always a place for it? No. Does that mean that's always the best choice for amplifying fear? Absolutely not. There are many movies where revulsion would be completely out of place, at least on that scale. That's about all I really have to say about the topic of revulsion for right now. I hope you all enjoyed it. I will be back next week or as soon as possible with another episode. I'm still trying to get some things in order. I do have a lot going on in the writing world as well. As I mentioned before, I wrote a splatterpunk story for Seekers Quarterly Fiction's fourth installment of their anthology Unsplatterpunk, which is splatterpunk with a positive message. So it can't just be nasty, gross, beating somebody's brains out, airborne entrails sort of story. It has to also carry a positive message, which I find to be a fascinating dichotomy. And I really enjoyed writing that style of story, so much so that I have written another one for them, and I don't know for sure if it's going to be in the anthology or not, but Seekers Quarterly Fiction is working on the seventh installment of Unsplatterpunk, and I am tossing my hat into the ring as one of the writers, and I have a story ready for them. I just need to finish up a few things on it. I have designed the cover for Unsplatterpunk number 7, as I also did with Unsplatterpunk 6 and Unsplatterpunk 4. So, I guess they like my visual artwork. But hopefully they'll like my story as much as the first one and as much as my visual art. No word on exactly when that will be out yet. The story is mostly done, so I still need to get it submitted. And then whenever Unsplatterpunk 7 is out, I will be talking about it, and it will at least have my cover art featured, if not a story by me inside. And it's been too long since I got something published, so it's good to get that done again. Moving forward, I'm going to be trying to do all the things. Historically, I've only been able to really focus on one thing, and everything else falls by the wayside. So I'm going to be trying to work on writing, working on cranking out this podcast, and working on my YouTube channel as well. Like I said, the new one is up. Check out my my YouTube channel. It's just my name, Edward Villanova, on YouTube. And I'm also starting a TikTok. I have a couple videos on there already, and I have a few more coming down the pipe. Again, just my name, Edward Villanova, on TikTok. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me for episode number 56. I will be back at you next week or soon after with episode number 57. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay creepy.